Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
All right, Jim Potts back on the air, and as always, thanks so much for tuning in and listening to me on your Sunday evening, wherever you are. I really appreciate that. Hey, today we're going to be talking about, well, there's this issue whether or not America is going into this moral panic over active shooters, and that there's really an overreaction that's going on right now. I'm not sure I understand that, but it was an article that was written by a columnist that I'm going to share with you and go through that. The second thing we're going to talk about today is workplace safety, employees' perceptions, and employer policies which are not in alignment. In other words, how employees view things versus what the employer may have in terms of policies. So we're going to go through that. And then we're going to be talking about mass shootings as well, talk about a little history on that, some things that I want to make you aware of, including some safety tips again for the work environment. So at any rate, let's get busy. I always like to start off with emails, as you're well aware. But before I do that, I have to tell you that this week I heard where there's a university that's actually passing out hockey pucks to their staff members, because they talk about how hockey pucks, I don't know if you've ever felt a hockey puck, but it is hard. So they're handing out hockey pucks as defense mechanisms for their staff, and I think even for the students, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know. If you have a chance, check out a hockey puck and see how hard that is. I had this vision that all of a sudden an active shooter comes and you got 30 people throwing hockey pucks at this guy, but I don't know. I don't know that takes the place of some of the other things we've talked about. But, hey, whatever you can do, you know, to save yourself, that's what's important. You know, last week we talked about this issue with domestic violence. And, you know, the outpouring from that in terms of some emails that I want to share with you today was really tremendous. So I have all these emails, but I'm gonna read off about three or four of those to you, because I think that they really hit home. So I'm going back to that first real quick. It says, Jim, I really enjoyed your last show on domestic violence. It really hit home. And it says, I believe that men can be abused. My husband was in an abusive relationship before he met me. He has a scar in the back of his ear where the woman tried to rip off his hair. She tried to strangle him, and he had to defend himself. She would call him names and say bad things about his daughter. This woman has made him afraid of him being yelled at. I see the damage that she has done. She still today is harassing me and him both. We have blocked her on Facebook, and she still finds ways to get at him. He endured 19 months of this and finally got fed up and left for good. If he had not left, I really believe she would have killed him. Well, I'm not going to be giving names out on this, obviously, because of the confidentiality of it. But there's a situation, and these, believe it or not, all really have to do with men. Because if you remember last week, we talked about women and we talked about men with this business about domestic violence and how some of it with men really actually doesn't get reported. So these emails that I have in front of me are sad but true. So I'll go through the next one as well. By the way, just as a reminder, if you want to call in and comment on anything today, the number is 818-602-4929. And you can, and by the way, you can always go to the website and get the number as well. Or you can email me, as so many people do it. Listen up with JP at PottsandAssociates.com. And as a reminder, if you want to get my blogs or email blast about upcoming show topics, text Potts Associates and text that to 22828 and enter your email. Again, Potts Associates, and then enter or put in to 22828 and then enter your email, okay? And I believe that's on the website also, so if you want to pick it up off of there. Let's take a look at this next email. Jim, your show on domestic violence was amazing. It was spot on. Men can also be victims, and I was one of those. For an extended time, my wife invented reasons to get violent. I wore a shirt one time the same color as the dress of a woman at her work. I had never met the woman, but she was younger than my wife and in her eyes, prettier. She would hit me, and after I learned how to block all of her blows, she started to grab my glasses and try to break them. I really couldn't see much without them. I have witnessed other people's case of similar actions, and no, it isn't who throws the first blow. It's who decided that it was going to become violent. In my case, I learned my wife had planned the violence before I walked in. I wish education and counseling was the answer, but there are so many forms of mental illness and people in denial out there. Thanks for bringing attention to this very troublesome area. Okay, there's another one for you. Next one. Jim, your show brought back a sad period in my life. You see, as an abuser against my now ex-husband, I feel sorry for the guys that do get abused. And hear what that just said, folks. You see, as an abuser against my now ex-husband. So this is the woman who is admitting that she abused her ex-husband and that she feels sorry for the guys that do get abused. I had issues that I refused to deal with at the time of my marriage because I said I didn't need help. The reality was I needed help, counseling, medication, self-evaluation, and whatever it was I needed. I needed it. I used to throw things at him, verbally abuse him and mentally abuse him, and after 4.5 years together, he left. He just couldn't take it any longer. Still, 14 years later, he doesn't trust me all that much. But he's starting to realize that I have changed, and I'm sorry for what I put him through. And the trust is small, but there is a small speck of trust there now. I want guys to stand together and say we are the silent victims of domestic violence. Just because society perceives guys as being stronger, sex doesn't mean it's true, because it's not. There are those amongst us that don't, can't, won't stand up to a woman, because if they do, they then become accused of violence against women and end up being persecuted for standing up for themselves. Somebody, anybody, start rounding up the guys who have been abused by women. Let this silence end. Let us hear your voice and start bringing it out to the open, because violence against men happens. Hey, I thought that one was really powerful, very powerful. And this is a woman that admitted that she's had the problem, and she's speaking out. And I think that was really, really important to be able to read that one. Okay, I do have one more for you that I want to read to you. You know, these are cases where people have really kind of stood up and decided to speak out. And I think that is very, very important. Mr. Potts, my son was killed by a domestic abuser, his wife. It was a few years ago, and she has gotten away with it. I have gotten involved in a number of advocate groups on behalf of men. I just wanted to say that thanks for bringing these issues to your show. It is one that is seriously overlooked. Thank you again. Well, there you go. Those are four emails that people sent in, and it really does honestly strike home for sure. So, let's now move on to the regular topics that we want to talk about today. There was an article that was written about America's increasing moral panic over active shooters. And this particular columnist thinks that it's overblown and counterproductive. And I'm going to reach out to my audience. You know, what's your opinion about that? Again, he's saying that America's increasing moral panic over active shooters is overblown and counterproductive. Now, his name is James Fox. He's an opinion columnist. And I guess he feels that active shooter situations have become the latest moral panic, and that FBI data and news coverage blow attacks out of proportion, causing us to fear the rarest of events. Now, I have to tell you, I mean, I see this all the time. It's unfortunate, but we do see a lot of this. And in the business that I'm in, with my crew at Potts and Associates, you know, we look at this, we hear the stories from all of these individuals, and of course we also see the things that are happening on TV where they're reporting the news as well. But look, although active shooting events can be devastating, according to Fox, the level of fear associated with this modern day boogeyman is out of control, leading to countless false alarms. And he talks about the fact that the reports that there was an active shooter that was barricaded recently sent employees scurrying for safety as teams of first responders rushed to the scenes. News of the crisis spread quickly throughout the national media, and the Twitter sphere. By the time officials gave the all clear, it became apparent that a planned active shooter training exercise had been mistaken for the real thing. Now, we've had clients that have contacted us and asked us to do active shooter scenarios. And to be honest with you, I really kind of refused to do it for a lot of different reasons. Some of them wanted us to do it without the knowledge of their staff members. But, you know, to me, that stuff can be, you know, very nerve-wracking for people. Panic, fear, individuals can, you never know. Somebody could have a heart attack. I think there's too much liability that's associated with that. So from my perspective, you know, we don't necessarily do that. Now, here, there was a situation where they used an exercise and it got mistaken for the real thing and it caused a lot of panic. Now, Fox goes on to talk about the fact that there was a unfounded report of an active shooter inside a California hospital recently, which prompted a code black lockdown of the facility and a massive police response. And come to find out, it wasn't true. And now look at the response and everything that happened. He cites down in Texas, where in a Texas mall created havoc when the sound of breaking glass was mistaken for an active shooting event, sending terrified shoppers rushing for the exits. Now, look, in all honesty, I mean, it's true. There is a certain amount of fear now that's being out there, but I don't think we can underscore the realities of some of these things. I'd rather have people get out than stay and start scratching their heads about what's going on, and all of a sudden now something happens. Now, you know, in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, I think it was last July, the word spread because they were doing a fireworks show, and all of a sudden the word spread through the crowd that there was an active shooter among them, sending thousands of people running for their lives. And guess what? There was no shooting and no gunman, just folks misinterpreting the sound of firecrackers. Well, look, once again, you know, these things are real. They're being sensationalized by the media. Our own fears are out there. There's just no two ways about it. But when he says that this business is overblown and counterproductive, I swear to you, I don't think that that's an accurate statement. I think that we do need to still be on guard. I think people need to follow the safety measures and things of that nature. Look, let's be realistic. Anyone who sits in a classroom or at his desk at work or visits a shopping mall or restaurant faces the possibility of confronting an armed assailant. That's just what it is these days. You have to think that way. Now, Fox doesn't think so. He thinks that the likelihood is akin to that of being killed by lightning. I mean, okay, there's a lot of people in this country. There's a lot of stores. There's a lot of restaurants. What are the percentages that something could happen? I get that. That's true. But what if you're the one that's in that store, or you're the one that's in that mall, or you're the one that's in that restaurant, or whatever the case may be, or the movie theater? Then my attitude is, don't you want to be prepared? So, you know, we always speak about awareness, and I think that that is a critical piece of it. Now, Fox seems to think, how do we get to the point where the term active shooter is relatively recent addition to our lexicon? You know, it reflects a menace of intense concern. Look, I have to agree with him on that. Matter of fact, I'm in the process of writing a book that I'll let you know about sometime next year when it's completed and ready to be sold out there. But, you know, one of the things that I talk about in there is how far back some of this goes. I mean, it's true. This is not new. But now people are really starting to hold on to it more so than in the past. Plus, media puts this out there. And sometimes they keep it live. So as a result of that, it is in the forefront. So I can understand what he's saying about that. It's not a recent addition. Now, I will say in recent years, let me just tell you, the FBI has produced a series of reports on active shooter events, dispelling a number of common misconceptions. There are misconceptions out there. And as an example, the latest update that they did was contrary to what many believe, and that is active shooters are generally not driven by serious mental illness. Moreover, they really do tend to target specific victims as opposed to shooting indiscriminately. But it happens both ways. You know, mental illness or not, some of these people are not mentally ill. Some of these people are just out there to get people. And sometimes you're just out there because they want to end their own lives, which, quite frankly, I wish sometimes if they just want to end their own life, why don't they just simply make it less spectacular and do it privately in their home as opposed to taking all these people with them? I never understand that logic about killing people because you yourself want to commit suicide. Maybe the reality is they don't feel that they want to go alone. I don't know. Some people argue that's maybe it's mental illness. I don't know. Maybe it's a fear of dying by yourself. I'm not a psychologist, folks. I don't know. Now, I will say that Mr. Fox doesn't appear to believe the FBI statistics. In his opinion, he remains dubious, I have to tell you. And it's in terms of the reported increase of active shooters over the past two decades, according to him, which has many observers, in his opinion, thinking in epidemic terms. Now, he points out that according to the FBI database, partially assembled by accessing news archives, the number of active shooters, defined as a gunman, by the way, actively engaged in killing or attempting to kill people in a populated area. I think I've given you that definition before. It actually grew from one case in 2000, which, again, this is, you know, what, 18 years ago. That had to do with seven employees in Wakefield, Massachusetts, who were killed at a place of business, to an average of dozens over the past few years. So what he's pointing out is that 2000 there was one, and now there's dozens over the past few years, according to the FBI database. Now, he questions that. He questions the increase in actual cases because he's saying that, in his mind, it's the ability to locate cases from years gone by is how they're doing it, especially when the press was not so vigilant in reporting on armed assailants who, despite their intentions, failed to kill lots of people. He's saying that it's hard to fathom that in 2000 there was not more than one person in this entire nation who picked up a loaded gun with the desire to kill many people in a public place. So that's why he's questioning the FBI's statistics. He's dubious about it. He doesn't believe them. And, you know, one of the things he points out is that, you know, there was a Pittsburgh man at one point who had killed five in a hate-inspired rampage. Now, he didn't make the FBI database, according to Fox. Now, I'm not talking about the recent situation in Pittsburgh. This would have been before that. So, I don't know. You know, he thinks there's an overreaction to it. And again, if you guys agree with him, let me know. If you disagree, let me know. Now, Fox's rationale is in the 4 years since the FBI, in the years rather, since the FBI began surveying active shooter events, he's saying 27% of the assailants failed to kill anyone. And in the first few years of the FBI database, only 9% killed no one. Now, either active shooters of recent vintage or poorer marksmen, or less serious, or there's less serious cases of early years were not identified. So, again, he's definitely of the frame of mind that the FBI doesn't know what they're doing, and that, in fact, they don't have all of the accurate information. So that's why he thinks that there's an overreaction. Now, the other factor driving misconception of risk is the over-the-top news coverage. And I have to tell you, from a certain standpoint, I don't know that I totally disagree with that, because there is over-the-top news conference, news coverage. They had this other episode that happened. You guys might remember it at the YouTube headquarters. You know, they put out a 911 call, you know, and, you know, satellite trucks and helicopters were dispatched to the scene, transmitting live images in the living rooms across America. See, that's another issue, and I don't disagree with him about spreading that kind of panic. But the first time you tell media, don't do something or you can't do it, or maybe you should tone some of this down, then they want to start yelling about their First Amendment rights. And yes, they do have a First Amendment right, freedom of press. I get that. And quite frankly, they want to be able to hover above you and put that camera right on there as the grotesque things are actually happening. Because for them, that's news coverage. That's what people want to see in their minds. And that's certainly things that they want to put out there. I don't agree with some of that with the news coverage. I think is what ends up happening is that it also gives people ideas and things of that nature to commit some of these crimes. And they piggyback it. They mimic it. They copy. They're copycats. And that's happened so many times with some of these active shooters, with this, with some of these school situations. Because if you follow some of those closely, the situations are almost identical to another shooting that's happened in the past. So, in Fox's mind, our fear really doesn't match the level of risk. He's saying that with all of these places out there, basically, and all the scenarios out there, that, you know, it's minimal that something could happen to you as a citizen. Let's just put it that way. And, you know, he feels that As a result, the level of fear is well out of proportion with the risk. And I get that. Again, you know, what's the risk of flying in an airplane? Very low percentage, but a whole lot of people don't like doing it because of what? The fact that they're afraid of flying. And if a plane does go down and you're the one in it, well, then you're the one that's in that percentage. So it's personal to each of us without a doubt. Now, his perspective is from an overall standpoint, he feels the most significant downsides to our hypervigilance are the constant reminder of the danger and the possibility of false alarms. I get it about false alarms. People can get hurt by false alarms because people panic first, okay? One of the things that we do in our trainings is to tell people about panic reactions versus fear reactions. So my feeling is that if people go over these scenarios in their minds over and over again, that if they actually get in a situation, that they're not going to have that panic reaction. They are going to have the reaction in a positive way, not a negative way. And they're going to know what they have to do, and they're going to do it, not in a panic, you know, in a panic mind, but from a reflex reaction was the word that I was searching for a moment ago. So panic reaction versus reflex reaction. Go over these scenarios. What would happen if? And if that happens, you'll be ready. You won't panic. You'll have a reflex reaction versus a panic reaction. And I think that's the way that we have to go. Now, Fox seems to think that the more we obsess over active shooters, the more we entice angry individuals to seek redress with a gun. And so he's saying the more attention that we draw to this, that it does put it out there for people who are going to, in fact, do things because they know that they're creating fear and panic in people. So, at any rate, that's Mr. Fox's interpretation of all of this. And like I said, I don't necessarily agree with all of it. There are pieces of that that I do agree with. But if you have any questions or concerns or comments, 818-602-4929. Do you think we're overreacting to this or not overreacting? And by the way, you can always email me, listenupwithjp@postandassociates.com. All right? Okay, now let's talk about some workplace safety. Because no matter, you know, I think I've told you on the air before that 80% of the active shooter scenarios actually happen with businesses. Now, here's the problem. When you start thinking about workplace safety, what is the employee perceptions versus the employer policies when they're not, when those policies are not aligned with the employee perceptions? Because when it comes to workplace safety, employers often miss the mark in critical communication and planning, according to these to recent surveys. They're not adequately prepared. That's one of the things that we do as a company now. We, in fact, go into businesses. We do the site assessments. We find out where the safe rooms are. We give a report back to the key contact and let them know everything that we found. And we create the workplace security plan for them, the procedures and protocols. And then we do active shooter training based upon that information. Now, some businesses out there have been working with some of the local police departments who have come in and done the active shooter training. And I think that that's still a good thing. The problem with it is that they don't do fully site assessments, and they don't write the procedures and protocols nor the workplace security plan. So I think it has to be a comprehensive type of piece, not just a partial piece. So, and you also have to keep in mind that it's been required by law since 1994 to have workplace security plans in place. So, look, when it comes to workplace safety, employers often miss the mark in critical communications. It's just that simple. You can't be unprepared to meet the future needs of your employees. That, to me, is extremely important. Now, I will say that the emergency plans, if you do have them in place, they need to get with their times. There's strict regulations out there that have been enforced for some time, and respondents made it clear that they were aware of their workplace fire drill policies. And it's what they were saying was that they conducted a survey, and they said that 87% of these plans have been established and have been practiced at their work in this particular survey. But they're only talking about fire drills. Fire drills. Fire drills don't get it anymore. Safety issues for what we're talking about is completely different. And by the way, if any of you employers out there that are listening, or managers and supervisors or business owners, let me tell you, we went into one company. It was a manufacturing company. And they were proud of themselves because they had outside in the parking lot where the parking lot was clearly marked off that in the event of emergency that people from A to D stand over here, people from E through H or something stand over here, and et cetera, all the way through the alphabet. So everybody was aligned out there by their last name. Now, one of the things that I told them was that I don't think that that's a good plan, because domestic violence is one of the major issues regarding this business of, you know, domestic violence. And if a person knows that, let's say their last name is Potts, and all they got to do is a bomb threat, they're going to empty the building. And where's Miss Potts going to be? Standing right there by the sign that says P. So in my opinion, that's not the way to do it, in all honesty. You know, even if they do it coded, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 or whatever, that's better than actually having them out there standing there by alphabet. And that way, each particular department knows that they're going to go to Section 1, possibly Section 2. And that's information, by the way, that we tell them not to share at home, whether in a situation or not, because it is a security measure from that perspective. Now, listen, employers. Given the current landscape of the workforce, your ability to focus on an active shooter workplace violent incident is absolutely paramount. You got to understand, you know, I understand what Mr. Fox was saying, but from an employer standpoint and to the businesses out there, you also need to understand about the liability piece, because the liability piece means that you could actually be sued because of the fact that you didn't have a plan in place, written plan, practice plan, whatever the case may be, because plaintiff attorneys will definitely jump on those scenarios and they will, in fact, hold you liable if you didn't do something in terms of preparing your staff for what might eventually happen. So you got to put them into practice. So once you get it, once you get your safety plan together, put it into practice. Now, word has it that the millennials, Generation Z, are less informed about workplace safety than baby boomers. And yes, I am a baby boomer. But these millennials and these Generation Z people apparently are less informed. Now, I don't know whether that's what they say. All right, that's what they say. I've got a couple of millennials working with me on our Violence in the Workplace Preparedness Program. And they're very much in tune to it. But they say that basically the rest of the millennials and Generation Z out there are less informed. Now, what we have to understand is as the workforce continues to evolve with a growing number of millennials and Generation Z employees joining the way, workplace security as communicated will also need to shift. Now, they say currently 53% of millennial respondents are unaware or said that their workplace did not have emergency plans in place. Now, when this was compared to the people that responded to the survey, age 45 and older, a big discrepancy was revealed. And that only 34% of the respondents in this age group responded the same way about their employer's workplace safety plans. So you could see that there is a definite difference, and the age difference dictates some of this as well. So why that is, I'm not sure. But I can tell you additionally, nearly half of the 45 and older age group said that they were very likely to report an issue in which they or a coworker's safety was in question, where only 8% of the millennials said that they were very likely to report an issue like this. So 8% versus 45%. Maybe the millennials don't care as much. I don't know. Maybe the older generation, so to speak, we're more in tune to these kind of things, and we don't mind speaking up and speaking out, which is how the baby boomers were. I mean, let's face it. We came through the 60s and the 70s where we would speak out about certain things. So maybe that's the reason. I don't know. Now, there has to be a preferred communication method within the organization. One, I can tell you one area where most of the people who responded to the survey could agree was around how employees prefer to be notified of an emergency. Now, both employees, these employees base their organization's main offices on remote workers, indicated text messaging was a top preference for receiving alert notifications. However, only 37% of them said that the workplace currently has a mass text message notification system in place. This is critical, people. Make sure your employers have some kind of system in place for communication in the event that something happens It's almost like having an Amber Alert, I guess. So be ready. Be ready. Because it looks like currently the top way of notifying employees about an incident that happens while they're in the office is through an intercom system. But when they are remote, I'm sure they would prefer an alert, you know, text message. Of course, the issue is always going to be who's going to be standing around sending out text messages. They're probably going to be getting the heck out of there themselves. So I don't know. So we'll wait and see. Okay. Now, when an active shooter event becomes a little bit more critical, the standard information or advice is given out there is that there's three steps. Evade the shooter, which makes sense. Shelter and barricade, which makes sense. Fight back. Counter intactive groups as you have. If you are near the active shooter or confronted by him, protecting yourself by attacking in a group can save your life. In other words, bum rush the guy. That's what you do. Collectively, just rush. Yes, somebody's going to get hurt. There's no doubt about it. But if you don't do that, a lot more are going to get hurt. And when faced with imminent danger, you got to fight with all your strength, anger, and the fierceness that you may have within you that you can muster. Reach down. Pull up that courage. Do what you got to do, but fight back. Use all of your strength, all of your anger, all right, and fight back. And I can tell you that research has shown that approximately 20% of would-be attackers are subdued by their intended victims. If you launch an unexpected counterattack, you send the assailant into fight, flee, or freeze mode. You can stop and detain the shooter or just scare him off by your actions. And when you do attack, look around your surroundings for an improvised weapon, coffee pot, scissors, canned goods, heavy objects. They all make good weapons. Make a pact with your colleagues that you'll work together to attack the shooter if you're ever in an active shooter situation. Throw things. Remember I told you earlier about the hockey pucks? Hey, get some hockey pucks. I don't care. But I can tell you there's already things in your work environment that you can pick up to throw if need be, or wherever you are. You got to prepare now to protect yourself. Evade, shelter, and barricade, and fight and counterattack is an optimal concept that will guide your response in an active shooter event. And that's easy to remember. You can use any step in order to protect yourself and others around you. Period. And that's the way that you have to do it. Pick up anything. Fight back. So, what did I tell you? Evade the shooter if need be. Shelter and barricade. But when it all comes down to it, fight back and do so in counterattacking groups. Get together with the other people in your organization. Hey, if this happens, what are we going to do? This is how we're going to handle it. And the time to prepare is now. You've got to be ready. So once again, Mr. Fox thinks that we're overreacting. I don't think we're overreacting at all. You got to be prepared because those percentages may be low. But I'll tell you this, if you're the one that's in the fight of it, all right, and you're fighting for your life, that percentage also at that point becomes awful large. So you get yourselves prepared out there and, be ready to do what you have to do to save your life and the lives of your coworkers or family or loved ones, whatever the case may be. Okay? All right. Now, I want to talk about mass shootings, which I told you in the email blast that we send out that we're going to be talking about mass shooters as well. And these situations. So people ask me sometimes, well, first of all, what are mass shootings? Because I think once before I might have mentioned the difference between, well, mass shooters and an active shooter. And it really boils down to the number of people that are injured or killed. Now, there's some myths out there about mass shootings. And here's the problem. In the rush to provide breaking coverage, news producers are faced with a challenge. Do they get to the story first, meaning arriving, or do they get there correctly? Most often, the former prevails. Accuracy of information is at times traded in exchange for winning the race to the air. Because what do they like to do? Breaking news. They want to be the first. And the information they have sometimes is not complete information, which to me, once again, is unhealthy for us. We need the right information. We should be demanding that from the media. Now, look, in trying to understand, the live news coverage, The realities are media personnel often the first to try to fit the breaking events into a coherent story. Let's face it, I get that. This process typically involves three distinct phases of news construction. First, news personnel, they rush to the scene. They interrupt regular programming with breaking news coverage and present a flood of uncoordinated bulletins announcing the extraordinary event. Look, I was on patrol one time, and I got a call out that I had to go respond because these family members had not heard from their aunt and uncle. I turn around and I responded to the call, and I get there, the people are standing outside the house, and I'm like, how can I help you? And they said, well, we haven't heard from Uncle so-and-so and Aunt so-and-so in 2 weeks, and we're concerned. Okay. You know, did anybody go inside? Do you have a key to the house? Yes. Did anybody go inside? No, we're afraid to go inside. Okay, well, let me have the key, and I'll go inside. So I go inside, and when I go inside, I can immediately tell from the odor that some people have expired or somebody has expired. I walk in the living room, and there's all the information on the table for the Neptune Society and funeral information, et cetera. So that puts me on notice that, okay, what do we have here? Do we have people that have taken their own lives, or is it a murder-suicide? What is it at that point? Because it's more than just the fact that somebody unexpectedly passed away. So I walk around the house. It's a two-story house. I finally walk upstairs, and I find both of the people that have expired upstairs. And as it turns out, one of them was a caregiver for the other one that had basically just given up, and the person who was being committed suicide, and the person who was receiving the caregiving literally just passed away because they didn't get the care. So I go back downstairs. I tell the individuals what happened. And at that point, because it appears to be a murder-suicide or a suicide or a combination of both, I have to lock the place up and wait for the detectives to get there. So I sent them away basically because I told them there's nothing they can do now. They received the information, and, of course, they were very aggrieved. So I'm sitting in my car, and the neighbor across the street tells me, hey, if you want to, you can park over here, because I got to be careful because that could be a crime scene where I am. So I said, okay. So I drove my unit to their horseshoe driveway, and I'm waiting. And I got to tell you, it was pretty nice. They were bringing me sandwiches and cold drinks, so that was pretty cool because nobody was responding. The coroner's office, the detectives, it takes a while for all that to happen. I can tell you I was out there 2 or 3 hours. And then what happens? All of a sudden, all of the media showed up all at once, as if all of a sudden they just found out just that those few seconds ago, after I had been out there for a few hours, they literally all showed up at the same time. I get out of my unit, and they come rushing up to me with these microphones talking about in the house behind this officer, two people were found murdered. It wasn't even the right house. It was the house across the street. Can you imagine you're sitting home and you're looking at the house behind me and that's where your loved ones are? I had to tell them. I got very upset, told them shut the cameras down. They had the wrong place. So and that it was across the street. And that's how this media is sometimes. Overreaction. The reality is, as more details become available either from eyewitnesses or from responding law enforcement, the media then work to correct past errors. Why? Because they rushed out there so they could be the first and put the situation into the proper perspective. From there, the media work to place the crisis into a larger, long-range perspective and to prepare people to cope with the aftermath. And even in those instances where the media works to correct the errors, the damage, a lot of times, is already done. And that's the sad part of this media business out there. Now look, what's a mass shooting? Mass shooting, rampage shooting, school shooting, mall shootings, movie theater shooting, active shooter events. And I can tell you that over the years, a variety of terms have been introduced into the media discourse to identify acts of mass shootings. These labels, often employed interchangeably, are utilized to put a particular event into context for news consumers under the presumption that responses to such tragedies will vary based on the number or age of the victims, where the shooting takes place, and who perpetrated the act. In reality, despite that, there may be variation in these characteristics as it relates to an event more generally. Mass shootings share many more similarities than differences. Still, the idea of what is a mass shooting, while seemingly easy to answer, has truly yet been hard to decide. And that's the problem with it. So this terminology called mass shootings, some just say it's over three people, over four people that were either shot or wounded. But, you know, shootings are shootings, in my opinion. So mass shooting means it was definitely more than just one or two. It was actually a few. Now, they have something, a new terminology now that's emerging. The new terminology that's emerging is what they call spree shooting. Spree shooting, S-P-R-E-E, spree shootings. But I got to tell you, before we consider a new definition, there's a more recent trend within mass shootings that must be considered. Because the idea of spree shooting, this business, as noted earlier, the FBI has differentiated between mass murders and spree killings, suggesting that the difference between these two types of events is the number of locations where the killing occurs. So now spree shooting is not just one guy at the mall. It's not what it is. So now that's what's emerging, and that's called spree shooting. And basically is what that is that if we think of the idea of spree shooting as those occurring over multiple locations, then when you look at that, should these events not be considered as such in addition to being labeled school or mass shootings because they're in different locations? Now, this is an important question to consider, particularly as mass shooters are becoming more mobile. And that's what we found out, you know, in some of these different events where a person has moved from position A to position B and continued doing the shooting. So the multiple locations now are now called spree shooting. So just to let you know that that now has been introduced in society as well. Now, the way that you have to think about that is that the shooting has occurred over multiple locations with no cooling off period. So the person moves from point A and then immediately moves to point B. And then from point B, they move to point C. Now, you know what they're doing. They're moving around like that because there's also less of an opportunity for them to be caught because they're moving from point A to point B to point C, possibly to point D. All right? Now, I had somebody one day ask me about this business of mass shootings, you know, and mass murder. Now, I can tell you that mass murder more generally has been characterized as occurring in the United States in two waves. It's two different situations, all right? The first occurred, and what I mean by that is that we had time frames for this. So the first wave, so to speak, occurred in the 1920s and 30s and mainly included acts of familicide is what it's called, familicide. The second wave began in the 1960s. It was on a considerably larger scale than the first. Now, the second wave was also characterized by more public mass shootings, beginning with the 1966 tower shooting at the University of Texas. Some of you might remember that if you're as old as me, let's put it that way, because it was definitely out there. Now, I want to tell you that the turn of the century in the first wave of the mass shootings that I just mentioned to you, the United States had found itself in a period of turmoil. Though a prosperous time for the country generally, the late 1920s and 30s, and no, I was not around that time, brought financial strife for a growing section of the population. And I can tell you that by October 1929, the catastrophic collapse of the New York Stock Exchange thrust the country into an economic depression. Now, I know you know about the depression. Hey, look, let me just tell you, that event, coupled with agricultural complications resulted from World War I, including overproduction issues and an inability to export crops to Europe, made it increasingly difficult for individual farmers to support their families. Now, this coincided with the first wave of mass murders in the 20th century, which largely consisted of familicides. And I'll explain what that is. Often occurring on rural farms. Increased stress brought by economic hardship plaguing the country. Are you ready for this? Resulted in fathers who, due to their inability to provide financial security, murdered their families in an effort to protect them from starvation and embarrassment. Did you catch that? They were so destitute that the father was killing their own families to prevent them from starving to death and the embarrassment of their financial ruin. These are farmers. So that was the first wave of mass shootings. It had to do with fathers killing their own families to stop them from starving to death. How sad is that? And where do we ever see or hear about those kind of things? Until I was actually doing this research, I didn't know that. I've never heard that. But it's true. It took place. Now, I'm sure people in the Midwest or where there's a lot of farming, they may know it, you know, in terms of their local histories and things of that nature. But generally speaking, I don't think this is public information. Farmers killing their families because of starvation during the 1920s and 30s, during the Depression. I mean, we knew that those were rough times. Now, I can tell you that the second wave took place in the 1960s. Now, that one happened on August 1st, 1966, where 25-year-old Charles Whitman climbed the tower at the University of Texas, and he was armed with a footlocker full of guns, ammunition, and other supplies, and he began firing at people who were walking across the university's open quad. And then for 80 minutes, he killed 15 people and wounded 32 others. Police responding to the incident exchanged gunfire with Whitman from the ground, creating a diversion so that other officers could ascend the tower and engage him. Ultimately, he was shot and killed by police. Sad. The subsequent investigation revealed that prior to his rampage, listen to this, Whitman had shot and killed his wife and mother in their homes. Then, on top of that, he left a suicide note calling for his body to be autopsied to determine if he had a mental disorder that caused the shooting. They did find that he had a malignant tumor during the examination, and it was believed to have contributed to the attack. But this theory was later refuted in the final investigation report to say that no, one had nothing to do with the other. But once again, he had a malignant tumor. He goes up into a tower. He kills 15 people and wounds 32 others. Now, look, recently I know you heard about the Thousand Oaks situation at the nightclub. And at the, I don't want to call it a concert, but it wasn't really a concert, but the country and western bar, the Borderline Bar in Thousand Oaks, California. But let me just tell you something. That killing that night made 307 mass shootings in the last 311 days, folks. Did you hear what I just said? That killing a couple of weeks ago at the Borderline bar made 307 mass shootings in the last 311 days. Now, that's a lot. And throughout that time, this time frame I just gave you, 328 people have died in those incidents. 1,251 were injured, according to the data. And that the numbers included incidents in which four or more people were shot or killed, not including the shooters. 328, you guys. And 1,251 wounded. This is within 12 months. There's 352 days in a year. And the year's not over. This is out of control. This is out of control. We've got to take a hard stance on it. We've got to look into this. We've got to try to resolve what the issues are. Now, I will tell you that the four biggest mass shootings in five decades happened in 2018. Four of the biggest mass shootings in five decades, that's 50 years, happened in 2018. And that is a lot. You had the Texas church shooting. You had the Borderline Grill. You had the synagogue. You had Parkland. Santa Fe High School, which a lot of people probably don't even know about. That is a lot. That is a lot. Four of the biggest mass shootings in five decades happened in 2018. And if you want to include the last 12 months, that would include also the Las Vegas shooting, where 58 people died. Okay, look, you've heard my pitch this week. I'm really happy about the fact that these people wrote in. on the emails and gave us their stories regarding the domestic violence situation. I thought that was good that they did that, because it does draw attention, like I said, to the fact that you do have men who are also victims of domestic abuse. All right, you've been listening to Jim Potts at LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/JimPottsAuthor. Be sure to join me next week. Hey, do me a favor. If you like what you heard, spread the word. Until then, be aware, be vigilant, and be safe.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.